I think it was Nelson Mandela who once said that critical, independent and investigative media is the lifeblood of any democracy. And that has become so important in the life of South Africa and in our democracy, particularly at this time. In recent memory, of course, we've had things like the Gupta email leaks. We've also had things like the Panama Papers that have affected global players and people in South Africa as well. But when we think of South Africa and its history, there's a long tradition of investigative journalism in South Africa. Back in the 1950s, we had Drum Magazine, remember, with some of the journalists that they had that investigation of what was happening in the prisons, what was happening on farms and some of the labor conditions. There were exposés as well of government corruption. There were exposés about Vlakplaas and the death squad that were revealed in several publications. So we have a long, proud tradition of investigative journalism in South Africa. So joining us on the line is Sam Saul. He's been a journalist since 1986, and he's worked for the investigative magazine Newsweek. He has served as a political editor at the Sunday Tribune. He's also worked at the Mail and Guardian. He was quite instrumental in the Oilgate expose that traced the involvement of the ANC-linked company in diverting money from a state contract to the coffers of the organization. And he was also instrumental in revealing the links between former police commissioner Jackie Selebi and slain mine magnate Brett Kebble and other underworld figures such as Glenn Agliotti. So we've decided to invite him as part of today's masterclass in light of the Gupta leaks for us to take a closer look at how investigative journalism works. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
So we invite in calls, and throughout the conversation, we're going to strive to really immerse ourselves and understand this particular area of journalism. Now, this particular, investigative journalism, like I'm sure other types of journalism, is active in nature. So you can't just sit and wait for information to come to you. So how do you often stumble upon these stories?
Yes, look, that is one of the things that distinguishes us perhaps from straight reporting, where the impetus comes from outside. We do try to prioritize and choose what we're doing. Well, obviously, there's always an interactive process with what's going on out there and new things that come into the public domain. But, I mean, I think all of us in the media are aware of the overwhelming news cycle in this country. There's so much happening. Mm. And so we at Amabungani, we try to prioritize and we kind of draw three big circles, if you like. Bad things that are happening in business, bad things that are happening in politics, and the bad things of crime. And where those three circles intersect, in other words, where there's a combination of business, politics, and crime, that's kind of where we try to set our sights, because we think that's where the most damage is done to our society and to our democracy. I'm afraid that I think the Gupta leaks fit right in that bullseye. That's why we're focusing on so much on that now.
You talk about how fast things are moving, how quickly the news cycle goes, and social media and event reporting has in effect really taken hold. How's that affected journalism, and as well as the impact that that's had on investigative journalism?
Look, I think we have a bit of a luxury as Amabungani, and it's part of the reason why we set it up to have the ability to have the time and the funding to step back from the rush of events and look more deeply at specific specific things. I think the pressure on daily journalists now is really overwhelming now that there are no kind of discrete deadlines. It's a constantly updating, constantly moving feast. So I think that represents a challenge to journalism, and it's always a challenge to step back, because you can be scooped, you can miss things, and so on. But I think you have to have the confidence to say, look, I'm investing this time in going deeper, and that is going to bring its own rewards, both in the reporting and just, you know, how deeply you can go and how much you can uncover.
And the reality is that it has changed the newsroom. This particular aspect does not necessarily exist in every newsroom. This idea of taking time, sometimes it could be days on end, and some stories develop over years. So it's not a luxury that many newsrooms can afford. How are you funded? How are you able to spend this kind of time and dedicate resources to a particular story?
Absolutely. We're acutely aware of the pressures, you know, financial and human resource pressures in every newsroom, and the increased kind of flow of you know, production that is expected to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we decided to set up a non-profit. Ama Mungane is a non-profit company. And so we went out to big foundational funders to get funding. That's people like the Millennium Trust, like the Open Society Foundation. There are about five or six separate entities that fund us.
Mm.
And when we started out, we were also associated with the Mail and Guardian, and they paid us, in a sense, a commercial fee for the right to be the publishers of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Of whatever we produced. But it got to the point where we wanted to grow, and they were struggling with that commitment. And so we went, about just over a year ago, we went on our own, completely independent, and the funding gap, we tightened our belts a bit. And the funding gap, which was about 33% of our budget, we decided we're going to raise that through small donations, through crowdfunding, through funding from individual South Africans who kind of see the value of what we do. And you know, I'm happy to say that model is working.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't think it's not an institutional solution. It's not a solution for the problems facing, you know, the media in general. It's kind of a niche solution that we can apply.
Yes, yes. And there's a real risk that this sort of expose, or this type of the exposure of what is happening might not continue if the funding dries out, or if society doesn't deem it to be of enough importance to sustain.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the problem is, we need to find a way to pay for good journalism. It used to be that advertising paid, but now all the advertising has kind of shifted to the platforms, to the Googles and the Facebook.
Right. Yes.
Who don't use any of that really to produce journalistic content. And I think societies need to find a way to fund journalism as a public good, because I think our experience in South Africa has shown. And as you pointed out correctly, we have a rich heritage, but it has shown, I think, over and over again, the importance of the society of quality independent journalism. But it has to be funded somehow.
Right. Sam, stay with us as we take this break. Senior investigative journalist at Ama Mungane Center for Investigative Journalism, one of the founders. In fact, he co-founded it in 2010. And we're looking at investigative journalism as part of today's masterclass. What would you like to know? We'll talk sources. We'll talk agendas. We'll talk about data, the kind of information that they end up having to sift through. That's all coming up in today's masterclass. And we'll also take your calls. 011-883-0702. Back with Sam Saul, senior investigative journalist at Ama Mungane Center for Investigative Journalism. And we're focusing the masterclass today on investigative journalism. We'll take your call, 011-883-0702. Now, Sam, let's go back to something that I mentioned earlier in the conversation about what triggers some of this digging. Is it that you feel a story was unresolved, or that there's a particular aspect in a story that's in the news cycle that is not complete, or is it just from what sources say to you about where you should start looking?
Look, it's usually a combination of all of the above. But, you know, there are certain things that are kind of basic, obvious givens. If you think about the Gupta story, what happened was in 2010, and our first publication as Amma Bongani and under that byline, we looked at President Jacob Zuma and his family and their business connections. And there are those associations, and it was mainly based on just kind of a public scan of publicly available information, company records, and that kind of thing. And the Guptas came up there. I'm kind of quite pleased to say that we identified them in that first story as far back as 2010 as people associated with him. Where his children were in business with them, were directors of some of the companies. But at that time, you know, they were only one amongst a number of sort of entities and individuals clustered around the president, and we didn't know then how important they would become. But I think, you know, what has given us an advantage now is that, you know, we continued to look at them. I think that the advantage we have, and the advantage I have of being, you know, over 50, is that we've looked at some of these things for quite some time, and that gives you background knowledge and allows you, in a sense, to pick up on the significance of events sometimes that other people without, you know, the history might not pick up as significant.
Right. And you often hear journalists saying that every source has an agenda. And that is probably true. So how is that agenda? How do you deal with that agenda? What is the process and how is it factored into handling a story and how you proceed with it?
Yes. Look, I think it's generally naive to think that sources come to you out of, you know, public interest and you know, without any kind of self-involvement and self-interest. That does happen, but it's generally the exception. So we're quite careful, you know, to look at the source almost as carefully as we look at what the source is telling us, and to factor in their interests, their agenda and their bias. But you know, that doesn't discount the usefulness of the person or the information. Generally, you know, sources come to you because they're angry. They're generally taking a risk, at least at the very least of you know, losing their jobs or something if it was found out that they come to you. There has to be a fairly strong motivation for sources to talk, and that motivation is generally, you know, generally anger. But again, you know, you have to deal with that by corroborating what people tell you with different sources, with information that you can get from court cases or written records or that kind of thing.
So, absolutely. So corroborating evidence.
Corroborating is key.
Because I remember, I think it was I can't remember the year, but a classic example of this is the allegations that Bulelani Ngcuka, who was then the National Director of Public Prosecutions, had been an apartheid spy. And as the story developed, it turned out that it had been driven by a political agenda. So that corroborating evidence is imperative. And in South Africa, the methods that can be used to gather all of this other evidence, because as a journalist or as an investigative journalist, you would have to go into areas that might not be your expertise.
That's absolutely true. You know, when we worked on the Oilgate story that you mentioned in the introduction, we had to become sort of instant, not experts, but at least familiarize ourselves with how the oil trade works, because there were, you know, in the beginning, various explanations given to us about why, you know, certain things were done and why there was nothing untoward and nothing unusual about it. And so we had to educate ourselves about an area that we didn't know anything about before we started. And that does happen again and again, and it's a very important part of you know, the journalistic and investigative journalistic process. When you approach a source, the more homework you've done, the more likely the source is to talk to you, that they will feel that they're not wasting their time. So that self-education is a key part of what we do.
Whether it's legal or whether it has to do with an industry that is nowhere near what you do. So I imagine you sit on a lot of data, that you're sitting on a bunch of information, a ton of information, and just having to make sense of it all so that you come out with a story that is unambiguous, a story where the point is clear and the importance of the story is unambiguous.
That's absolutely true. The sort of what you leave out is key, as key as what you what you put in. And you know, selecting you know, the information that is relevant to making a case and making an argument is key. And that's one of the, you know, that's one of the difficult things about taking a mass of facts and turning it into a story that is, makes sense and is a compelling argument, you know, suggesting one thing or another.
Yes, because there have been times where stories are passed off as investigative stories, but only end up as hinting at wrongdoing. And reports should make it clear what kind of misbehavior or crime has been committed or has been exposed.
Look, I think that's obviously the ideal, but I think we've also been guilty, if you like, of in a sense going as far as we can based on the facts that we have,
mm-hmm.
And merely suggesting concerns or associations without being able to prove them yet. But that sometimes that is justified and it's necessary, and sometimes when you put a story out there in the public which only goes half the way, then that is also a way of encouraging people to come back to you with further information, of kind of dangling a hook and hoping that there will be some more fish that bite.
That's an interesting point, Sam. Let's keep it there, and we'll come back to continue our masterclass on investigative journalism. Sam Saul, senior investigative journalist at Amapunganis. And we're taking your calls. Just to share some of the comments with you, Sam, on our SMS line, there's Sidwell from Tsutsumani saying, "Azania, you just took me back to the days of Drum Magazine when it came out once a week, not weekly as it is now, but got glued to it because I got to know about the abuse meted at potato farm, meted on potato farms towards the workers in Bethany, domestic workers, and the best journalists like Stan Mutsuwadi, who were playing a part in the trade." And another one that's unsigned says, "Where did the name Amapungane come from? Is the team mostly white? Are there black people that work there?" It's an unsigned SMS. So, Sam, where does it come from? Because I've looked at the team, and it's an eclectic mix of different people from different backgrounds. So I guess the perception, this one person's perception is very incorrect. All they have to do is go onto your website.
Yes, no, they do. Look, there are a couple of old white farts like myself and co-founder Stefans Birner, but there are other, you know, young up and coming black journalists as well, and we also have an outreach program in which we bring fellows. We have a fellowship where journalists from the SADC region and from South Africa come and work with us for 3 months, and then go back to their newsrooms, hopefully with improved skills, and that process comes out of our budget. Amapungane, when Stefans and I were thinking about setting this up, it was at the time when the Scorpions were under attack. You'll remember the Scorpion investigative, state's investigative unit attached to the National Prosecuting Authority. And we didn't quite think we made the grade as scorpions. We're not as big and scary as scorpions, but we thought, well, can we think of another insect that maybe fits the bill better?
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought of the dung beetle, which in Zulu, correct me if I'm wrong, is Amabungane. And our slogan is we dig for dirt and we fertilize democracy. So we're not so scary, but we're trying to do the same thing in a way.
So that answers those two questions. And then on Twitter, Helena says, are they protected when doing their work since they deal with unsavory people most of the time? And also the reality is that journalists are losing their lives all over the world for doing their work. A total of 115 journalists died in 2016 simply for doing their jobs. And this was in that alarming report compiled by the International News Safety Institute. It was entitled Killing the Messenger. So it speaks to this very question that Helena is posing. What risks have you and your team, are you taking?
Look, hopefully we take, only calculated risks and we're not reckless. And I think in South Africa, there has been generally a respect for the jobs that journalists do. And there's been a sense that in some ways, journalists are off limits provided they are doing, their job professionally and so on. And I think that's why the, recent moves, by Black First, Land First to target individual journalists, at their homes and so on was a really concerning development, and why SANEF, the South African National Editors Forum, went to court and obtained an interdict to interdict them from doing that kind of thing. Because really, we do try to operate in the public interest, and that's kind of the only protection that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's about the size of it.
Yeah, I think of Makosi Khoza, the MP, Dr. Makosi Khoza, coming out to make the statements that she has made, even though she's facing threats, that the public needs to know about this, and that in some ways provides a level of protection. Would you agree with that? The kind of protection that public awareness or public sentiment provides?
Yes. It's always a difficult choice and a difficult judgment to make, especially with sources who are sometimes putting their careers at risk, and possibly putting their lives at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have to tell them or suggest to them that coming out openly, saying everything and leaving nothing hidden may be better protection than trying to stay secret and feeding things out bit by bit, because if you really have a big secret and you're really a threat, then that may be the time that before you've actually given all your information that you might be particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always a very difficult a difficult thing to assess, and sources have to make that decision, but we have to try and help them make that decision. It's journalists' task to take some responsibility for the safety of sources. Very yeah. often, a journalist will have been in that situation, will have had much more experience than a source about how vulnerable they are, or what precautions, just in terms of being identified, they might need to take. So that's one of the things that we do try to do.
Yes, but on the other side, the credibility of a report often rests on the source, of the information. And, as readers, I know that we would do well to look very closely at the sources used, and we always see the fact that sources are kept anonymous. And yes, there's good reason for that. Are reports with named sources, do you feel that those are more credible?
Look, obviously, it's always better to know, for a reader to know, look, this is the person who's providing this information, because it allows the reader to assess the credibility and any possible agenda that person may have. But mm-hmm. we know that in many circumstances, I mean, political reporting, it's pretty standard. Almost all political parties, outlaw talking to the media without following the formal processes, and it would be impossible to do political reporting without having off the record sources. But I think it's important to be careful of those sources. As I say, that the issue of corroboration, of having multiple sources, becomes much more important where those sources are going to be kept anonymous.
Yeah.
And that's also where our credibility comes in as well, because people are partially trusting the reporter, not just the source. So you're trusting the reporter to have done the due diligence, and so we do need to do that due diligence to kind of meet the trust that is put in us.
Right. Let's take this call from Colgate. Good afternoon, Colgate.
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Yeah, I was just listening, as I'm driving,
mm-hmm.
and where the name Amabungani comes from,
mm-hmm.
and I recall that in Robben Island, people that were in Robben Island had taken this concept a little bit further as well. If in Xhosa, there's a saying in Xhosa, if you heard news about anything worth knowing, you would say, and if you don't want to disclose your source, you would say, I've heard it, and then this Xhosa saying is, "Live ngembukane eziluhlaza." Roughly translated in English, I've heard it from the blue flies.
Hmm.
And the fly, of course, and Amabungane, is the same species of flies. And in Robben Island, specifically for that, if you've heard news that you do not want to disclose your source, you would say, using the Xhosa phrase, from Amabungane.
Hmm.
Is it not coincidental that you've used the name? Maybe you didn't know that's the case,
mm-hmm.
but indeed it is the case.
Hmm. That's a beautiful call, Colgate. Sam, there's something to add.
I didn't know that. That's lovely to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you very much
that call. So I guess you have the right skills to corroborate this particular story. that indeed is the case of what used to happen on Robben Island. That was lovely indeed. So we're taking more of your calls on 011-883-0702 as we look at the world of investigative journalism. Now, what about undercover journalism? I'm sure that it's a controversial aspect, and that maybe there are times where it is important to do that, or where it's necessary, that it's in the public interest to send in an undercover journalist. And also maybe when it comes to exposing shenanigans happening in a very closed off organization, within a closed off organization, say like FIFA, which is like a boys' club. So is that ever a consideration or a tool that you've used?
Look, that's a very important tool. And some journalists have done really wonderful work. It's not a tool that I use very much because I'm a very bad liar myself, I think. I wouldn't be convincing. But for instance, we worked with the Guardian from the United Kingdom on the early days of the arms deal investigation, and one of their journalists they set up a fantastic undercover operation where they set up a website with a fake company name and so on, and they pretended to be essentially one of these risk assessment or management companies. And they went and to Czechoslovakia, where British Aerospace had also been involved in selling arms and allegedly bribing people. And they got a number of politicians from different parties to talk about how British Aerospace had operated in peddling or seeking to buy influence in order to clinch the deal.
Mm.
And it was one of the sort of beautiful examples of that. But that generally requires a lot of specialized skills and backup. You tend to have to, you know, have secret cameras and so on. And we don't do that kind of thing generally.
Mm-hmm.
And much of what we do is outsiders would regard it as pretty boring. It's going through accounts, going through documents, looking for court papers, struggling to get access to documents and court papers because they tend to get hidden away.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is not as exciting as that kind of undercover work.
Yes, and I imagine that between the various stages of progress, you must get really, really frustrated waiting for the court or waiting for the next step to be complete for you to proceed. It must be incredibly frustrating.
Look, it is frustrating sometimes, but we don't often have the luxury of just concentrating on one thing.
Right.
We tend to juggle several balls, and that's because, you know, you make progress on one and then the progress stops, so then you can try to push ahead on something else, and then a month down the line, you know, a new fact might come to the fore, or a person or a witness or something, which will then push the other story ahead.
Right.
So we try to keep busy on a few fronts. Sometimes that's a bit self-defeating because you find yourself trying to do too much at once and therefore not making a lot of progress. So it's mm-hmm. one of the challenges to juggle focus and the spread of one's efforts as well.
Right. Amos, you're calling from Pretoria. You were responding to what Colgate had to say. Hello, Amos.
Hi, I'm Yonsi Savanya.
Yes.
Good afternoon to your listeners. Yes, it's Savanya. For us, being a Zulu, Amapungani, as your caller Colgate means, is a green fly.
Mm.
And if you say that you get the information from reliable sources, but you don't want to disclose it, we just say that we heard it from Amapungani Alsaza.
So it is.
And I can tell you, if we are being followed by Amapungani Alsaza, then we say that, hey, you can try to hide, but Amapungani Alsaza are very terrible. They're going to expose whatever you do.
Yes.
So the moment I hear the name Amapungani, I say, there is trouble for whoever it is. I pity those people.
Oh, fantastic call. So there's your corroborative evidence, Sam, that the story holds, and it's a perfect name.
Yeah, no, well, I hope we continue to live up to the reputation of the good reputation of Amapungani.
Mm. Now, just tell me on the score. I've been very curious.
Mm-hmm.
Would we be surprised at how willing people are to talk and just tell you something? So if you're looking into a story, just picking up the phone and, say, speaking to someone or anyone who answers in the building, you want to do a story on Prime Media and someone just picks up, and people are they just willing to talk? Is it easy to also just get and extract information from random people in that way?
No, generally not. You know, I think particularly, you know, we generally go after fairly sensitive areas of information, and I think people are generally aware, basically, of who we are and the topics that we're asking about tend to be quite sensitive. So
mm-hmm.
so it's not easy to get people to talk, but I mean, I think, for instance, in the state capture stories that you know we've been doing even before the Gupta leaks came out, there were some very brave individuals, especially from within state-owned enterprises, and I must say, particularly black women, who, you know, I think at quite a considerable personal risk, opted to talk to us because they were so concerned about what was happening where they worked and about irregularities and issues that they wanted to bring to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
You know, it is difficult to get people to talk, but you know, again, from time to time, I'm humbled by, you know, the South Africans who are prepared to to take the risk and speak out.
Oh. And the role of the financial sector, because we often hear about following the money, that if you can follow the money, then you will be able to complete the story. So uncovering illicit finances, financial secrecy, companies perhaps or individuals that are involved in tax avoidance and so on. What is the role of the banks, accountants and lawyers, especially when it comes to the money side of things and uncovering the money trail?
Yeah, look, that's one of my pet hates in a way, and that is the outwardly respectable enablers, the thugs in suits that one might call them, who make a lot of these scams and deals possible. Big financial fraud and corruption and money laundering is not possible without the help of these enablers, the accountants, the consultants, the lawyers, etc., who provide a kind of a screen for what's going on. Mm. The other thing is, for generally, we get hammered now and again for focusing on the public sector, and I could come back to why we think that is a key thing to focus on, but we also are acutely aware that that there's always a private sector person paying the bribes in order to get a public benefit, and we do try to go after those people as well.
Right. Sam, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your experience with us on this very important aspect of journalism. Thank you.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
That's Sam Saul, Senior Investigative Journalist at Amabungane Center for Investigative Journalism.